I do not think that I should apologize.
Truth is never illustrated through the use of violence. This is one of the guiding principles that sits at the core of the illuminated thinking created by the man known to the world as Mahatma, the great soul, moral and spiritual teacher, founding father of India. Against the violation of human rights, and even when provoked, he would refuse to denounce his aggressors, ever more convinced that non-violence is the only way to combat violence itself. On the basis of his traumatic experiences in South Africa, Gandhi developed the concept of satyagraha, that literally means adhering unflinchingly to the truth. As Gandhi saw it, physical force is only used by weak people. Real strength resides in a person's capacity to express their ideals. On the 11th of September 1906, Gandhi publicly proclaimed his philosophy for the first time. Public support was virtually universal. One must never oppose arrest. One must never oppose the law. One must never respond to violence with violence. But one must strive to affirm vigorously the will of the people and uphold religious freedom.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast or listening to A Time to Break Silence with the great Reverend Martin Luther King.
A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values. That is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war. There's nothing to keep us from molding a recalcitrant status quo with bruised hands until we have fashioned it into a brotherhood. These are days which demand wise restraint and calm reasonableness. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the land are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has a revolutionary spirit. Therefore, communism is a judgment against our failure to make democracy real and follow through on the revolutions that we initiated. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. With this powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo and unjust mores, and thereby speed the day when every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight and the rough places plain. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This call for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all mankind. This oft-misunderstood, this oft-misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly force, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of man. When I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I'm not speaking of that force which is just emotional bosh. I'm speaking of that force which all of the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. This Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality is beautifully summed up in the first epistle of St. John. Let us love one another, for love is God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. Let us hope that this spirit will become the order of the day. We can no longer afford to worship the God of hate, or bow before the altar of retaliation. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. History is cluttered with the wreckage of nations and individuals that pursued this self-defeating path of hate. As Arnold Toynbee says, love is the ultimate force that makes for the saving choice of life and good against the damning choice of death and evil. Therefore, the first hope in our inventory must be the hope that love is going to have the last word, unquote. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, that is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumble residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. That is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. Omar Khayyam is right, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the sons of God, and our brothers wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against their arrival as full men, and we send our deepest regrets? Or will there be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours. And though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. As that noble bard of yesterday, James Russell Lowell, eloquently stated, once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, often eats the gloom of blight, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness and that light. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet 'tis truth alone is strong. Though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. And if we will only make the right choice, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. If we will make the right choice, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. If we will but make the right choice, we will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
That was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Beyond Vietnam. He spoke at Riverside Church in New York on April 4, 1967, exactly 1 year to the day after his speech. Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis. The Nobel Peace Prize winner was only 39 years old.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, Nobel laureate Lima Bowie talks to Tavis Smiley just days before being named a recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. This remarkable single woman of six talks about her memoirs, Mighty Be Our Powers, and the challenges faced by women in politics. After watching her native Liberia descend into a lengthy civil war, Lima Bowie decided to take a stand. A social worker by profession, she mobilized a coalition of Christian and Muslim women that changed history, eventually paving the way for Africa's first democratic election of a female head of state.
In October of 2011, we were honored to be joined here by a remarkable woman from Liberia. named Lima Bowie when her homeland was being torn apart by a tribal conflict and a brutal government regime, Bowie proved the difference just one single person can make in our world. Despite being a single mother of six, Bowie encouraged the women of Liberia to organize and fight for peace. That effort was the single most important factor in the remarkable rise of Africa's first elected female head of state, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. But when Lima Bowie joined us back then to discuss her book, Mighty Be Our Powers, we had no idea that within 48 hours after that conversation, she'd go on to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Let me start with this quote on the back of the book for a particular reason. The quote says, and I quote, "Lima bore witness to the worst of humanity and helped bring Liberia out of the dark. Her memoir is a captivating narrative that will stand in history as testament to the power of women, faith, and the spirit of our great country." It's written by Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the president of Liberia, the first woman, as you well know, to be president of your native homeland. A year ago, 2009, as a matter of fact, April 7th, as I recall, 2009, President Sirleaf sat in that very chair. I was honored to have her on this program for a conversation. And I asked her a question about what being a woman did for her, how that aided and abetted her or challenged her in becoming the first woman president of Liberia. And here's what your president had to say.
As a man, I would have had so many kind of interests, you know, so many things to claim my attention. I would have not been so focused, so concentrated, you know, or wanted to be a successful professional. I would not have been able to speak out in a manner in which I could. Because I think, you know, men and their camaraderie, we want to make sure everybody, the forceful positions I took, I think came from the fact that as a woman, I felt I could speak.
I want to start with that, Lima, because there's no way that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf becomes president if women like you courageously don't pave the way for that moment to happen. So what do you make of your country now having a woman as president as we are about to approach the re-elections now in Liberia?
It was for me, 2005 was an exciting moment because I felt like we were ordinary women doing our protests and advocating for peace. And then having a woman's president was like the intro to our story coming to the limelight. Mm. Because I often say that there's no way anyone can tell the story of Madam Sirleaf and don't say what the women did for peace. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. But it was really an exciting time because it's been years. Liberia got her independence in 1847. It was not until 1957 that women could vote. Mm-hmm. So almost 100 years after independence, before women could vote. So we had waited all of these years, and then we finally got the female president. It opened up two things. First, we had a whole population of young women who had been destroyed by the war, and they were at a place where sex, their bodies, all of the abuses was what they knew. And the war really pushed them back into that subservient place. Having a woman's president brought them out. We had a whole generation of older women who never really thought that politics and the involvement of women in politics was something that they were supposed to do. Ellen, also, her elections paved the way for that. So it opened up a whole new avenue of possibilities for women in politics.
I want to get more to the backstory of your life and what made this moment for her and your nation possible. Before I do that, as I referenced a moment ago, we are just days away from elections in Liberia. President Sirleaf standing for re-election. What's going to happen in those elections, you think?
Well, I'm a serious optimist. I come from a country where you have little to be hopeful for, and so you have to always be an optimist. I'm optimistic that she's going to have a first round win.
Mm-hmm.
First round win. That's how optimistic I am. People say that's too much to be asking for, but I think there are two challenges ahead of us as women of Liberia. One, African women are saying to us, your failure to re-elect Ellen is going to prove to us that you are not as powerful as we thought you Liberian women were. Mm. That's the first thing. The second thing, it is like now we've seen development roll out in a way that we've never seen. I have never seen it in my own lifetime like I'm seeing now. And I think we should continue in this trend and then start to prepare someone to take over after she leaves. So I think she's going to have a first round win. Mm-hmm. It's a tough call, but she's definitely going to.
Yeah. What to your story now, and it's told beautifully in this new text, but what motivated you, or put another way, what compelled you to put yourself, literally put your life on the line to motivate, to empower, to bring women together, and to do so, bringing Christian and Muslim women together, which is remarkable for me.
Tavis, we had no life. Mm. So there was no life to put on the line. You wake up in the morning and you were grateful. Grateful for what? Nothing. Because it was always in the back of your mind that one bullet could take you out and you could be gone. You go to bed at night, you're grateful to be sleeping, but then sleep would never come. We had a horrible life. Rape was an everyday thing. Our children were being adopted and sent off to fight. So there was absolutely no future. No one is promised a tomorrow as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But people plan for tomorrow. When a nation gets to the place where there is no planning and no hope that there is a tomorrow, someone had to do something. And it was at that point that we, the women of Liberia, decided we will die sitting. So let's die trying to bring peace.
Mm.
And that was the motivation for us. We needed to secure the future for our children. So for me, I had 4 children at the time. And they were not with me. They were living as refugees in another country. That was no life. I thought, let me get out there. Sisters, let's do what we have to do. And those women who had seen the worst decided, we will step out. We will do what we have to do. Even if we die trying, we will do it.
Tell me, Lima, what the purpose was and how you came upon the idea to just sit holding those signs and always sitting, again, women, Christians and Muslims together, wearing white. Tell me more about that.
When we decided to do the protest, we had different ideas. And the first thing was we had no idea about Dr. King, nonviolent struggle. The rest of the women, I had read King, I read Gandhi. But these were women who didn't have any ideas of any of these things. The only thing they knew was the Bible and the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And the Christian women were saying, let's do as Esther did when the children of Israel were under threat.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to God in our sackcloth and ashes. And we didn't have the literal sackcloth and ashes to put on, so we thought white. But then also as we put on the white, no makeup, no jewelry, and we cover our hair. So that's how the white came about. So the white was symbolic or symbolizing our sackcloth and ashes. And then we decided we would do it fasting and praying. And every day as we went out there to fast and pray, we thought, let's not keep it inside. Let's take it outside. And we decided to take that fish market because it was the major highway for President Taylor going home mm-hmm. and going to work every day. Then someone said, let's picket. At the end of the day, we kept our focus. It was about the peace of Liberia. It was about the future of our children.
Mm. I am struck by, and I want to ask you to comment on this. I am struck by, and it's in the subtitle of your text, but we live in a world where not everybody values the power of prayer, no matter who you're praying to. If you're a Christian, you're praying to God. If you're a Muslim, you're praying. I mean, so you bring in, again, these Christian and Muslim women together, but the one thing they have in common, the one thing they agree upon is the power of prayer, which, again, for some people is so overrated these days. But talk to me from your perspective about the power that's pregnant in prayer.
There is no way that I can talk about the work that we did, or there is no way that the success of this work can be documented without the religious or the prayer part, mm-hmm. that part of faith.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sitting on your shore today, and it's evident of the power that God has in using the foolish things of this world to confront the wise.
Mm.
When we started our work, we could not have gotten the boldness to step outside if we weren't praying to God. So every morning we went, we said a Christian prayer, we said a Muslim prayer, and we sang. Service, no one, not a single being in this world can leave their children at home knowing that I could be protesting for peace and a missile could land on my house and do that protest faithfully for 2 years without prayers and without the power of the faith in a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that everything we did was that guidance, that hand carrying us. There were times that we would decide we're going this place to do something. Some of the very people in Taylor's government would be the one calling our cell phones to say, don't go.
Mm.
And it's only through the hands of God that these things happen. The world that we live in now, people don't believe these things. They tend to put it. But the work of the Liberian women, God first, our the nature to persevere second, I think that's what gave us the success. But 100%, even from the beginning of the work, it was divinely inspired.
The shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, uh-huh, ooh, Sunday morning, uh-huh, lies a body just oozing life, and someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat, down by the river, don't you know, where a cement bag just drooping on down. Oh, that cement is just, it's there for the weight you dare. Five will get you ten, old Mackie's back in town. Not you hear about Louis Miller, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie, he spins just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Now, Jimmy Diver, ho, ho, yeah, Suki Tawdry, woo, Miss Lottie Lenya, and old Lucy Brown. Now that Maggie's back in town. I said, Jenny Diver, whoa, Suki Tawdry, look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that line forms on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in town.
And now for something completely different.